The dictionary definition of a statesman is one who is versed in the principles or art of government, especially one who is actively engaged in conducting the business of a government or in shaping its policies. It is also a wise, skillful, and respected political leader. We're exploring statesmanship on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. These admirable leaders of the 20th century made progress on issues that were considered intractable for generations. One such statesman was Mikhail Gorbachev, whom President Ronald Reagan addressed in June 1987 when he stood in front of Berlin's Brandenburg Gate.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
2 years later, Gorbachev allowed that. Here with us to discuss Gorbachev's role as a peacemaker, plus a look at other leaders who and consider what we can learn from these leading the way in the 20th century is Bruce Gentleson. He is a public policy and political science professor at Duke University. Areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy globally and in particular the Middle East. He's also the former senior advisor to the director of policy planning at the State Department between 2009 and 2011. His new book just out, it's called The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. Bruce, so good to have you back on the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you again.
So help us understand what makes a good leader, especially on the global stage, because you grappled with this.
Yeah, it's really an important question, you know, because sometimes we overplay the role that leaders have, and other times we underplay it as if they're interchangeable parts. And in thinking about it and experiencing it somewhat, you know, I start with the notion that every leader, they can't do everything on their own. They have constraints, and they sometimes have conducive conditions. But at crucial turning points in history, we really see the choices that key individuals made as shaping the world. And those are the areas that I focus on. Gorbachev is one of the examples we do. And then, of course, they have to bring people along. They never do it totally on their own. But the focus of this particular book was really on unique individuals. Where do they come from? How do they do what they did? And where did they? What were the limits? Where did they not succeed?
Do the leaders share any key traits that are through lines, that are commonalities between these leaders that you looked at?
Yeah, we do have a range of leaders here. Not all are leaders of governments. And I think a couple things are true. One is that they bring what I call personal capital to the table. It's not just the powers of their position structurally or as defined, but they have, whether in some cases it's a moral capital, you know, like a Mandela that, you know, had this sort of sense of values. In other cases, it's just that people believe in them and their skill set. But they do have to combine that personal capital with two other things. One is political skills. Our story of Gorbachev ends poorly, you know, where he ultimately could not. He did great things for the world, and what he was trying to do at home, he couldn't consolidate it because his political skills failed to keep the opposition at bay. And the other is sort of answering the why question. You know, why change? Change is always a frightening thing. Yeah, it's true probably a lot in our personal lives and not just in policy. And you have to give people a sense of what's wrong with the present, where you want to take them, and make them reasonably comfortable with that they can hang in there with you, because change often has lots of bumps and lots of ups and downs. And so there has to be, I don't call it an ideology, but just a vision and a story that people can believe in.
You found at moments that this book brought uplift to you, brought hope to you. What inspired you to look at leaders from the last century and look at their challenges they faced?
Well, I think part of it was looking at the world today. You know, when the Cold War ended, you know, back in the early 1990s, and, you know, Nelson Mandela got out of jail and change was peaceful in South Africa, and we had a sense that the whole world were becoming democracies and market-based capitalist economies. That all probably seems very foreign to to your listeners right now, but that was, you know, maybe 20 years ago. And, you know, since then we've seen, you know, more tensions between the U.S. and Russia, globalization having winners and losers, and many other things. It's easier to point to things that are wrong with the world than progress is being made. And so I thought it was really important at this point in time to think about, okay, where have there been other intractable problems that people, you know, if you went to Las Vegas, you could have gotten great odds that they wouldn't be resolved or even significant progress made. And have them be in a period that's reasonably close history. And what can we learn from that? What, how can the stories be inspiring themselves? But what lessons can we then apply to the 21st century?
And you get a little bit of philosophical in your book. Does history make statesmen, or do statesmen make history? What's the answer to that?
It's in the middle.
Of course,
you know,
it is.
I think it's dangerous to get into hero worship or to say, you know, let's just wait for the next great leader to come around. I spent a lot of time inside the Beltway, and I think there people pay too much attention to personality. I think in the university academic world, there's probably too little to individuals. And so since I am also a baseball fan, I use the, in baseball statistics, they have this money ball statistic they call wins against replacement player. How much does a shortstop, say the Milwaukee Brewers, contribute to their victories compared to every other shortstop in baseball?
Mm-hmm.
There's a fancy statistical formula, which I don't do, but I ask the same question. Would another leader have made the same decisions and carried them out as much as this leader? And everybody in the book, again, including leaders of social movements and human rights and the like, I answer no, that it was really unique aspects of this individual, and that's what made the difference in these stories.
Well, certainly key to bring brewers into the conversation. So how did you apparently started with a list of more than 100 leaders, possibilities. How did you whittle that down to, you know, about a dozen or so?
So I had a couple of criteria I used. One was that these were all transformational moments, not perfect peace. That would have been a very short and thin book. But significant breakthroughs on issues that, as we said before, were long thought intractable. And so it wasn't just the daily business of diplomacy. Second was this notion of the impact they had, not just the position they held. So there I do bring in some human rights leaders, leaders of some social movements, to try to show that we can have breakthroughs not just from leaders of governments. And then I say that these are examples that I think are really good examples of the different types of breakthroughs in peacemaking, but they're by no means, you know, exhaustive. And as I was developing the book and giving talks, you know, in the U.S. and in other countries, I'd, you know, get from people, why don't you include so-and-so or so-and-so? And if I was really tech savvy, I'd have a social media game going where people in their book clubs could make their nominees. But I feel like the people in the book make the points. And as people have suggested to me, other leaders, you know, I haven't said no. I just said that's another good example.
Yeah, I suppose you could put together a fantasy football, the Peacemakers edition. Bruce Gentleson is with us, author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What world leader from the 20th century would you add to a list of peacemakers, and why? What do you think we can learn from the world leaders like Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, and Woodrow Wilson? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Well, Bruce, let's turn to one of the figures in your book who managed a major power rivalry. That was Gorbachev. And we heard a clip from him earlier. Why did Gorbachev make it into your book? Why was he a choice?
I think that, and in the story, you know, Ronald Reagan, consistent with your clip, definitely was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, as were others, like Pope John Paul II, the Polish Pope. But when I asked the question, who was the truly indispensable figure, there are some people that argue, oh, he had no choice because the Americans were building Star Wars. He had a lot of choices, and all the Soviet leaders before him didn't make them. Margaret Thatcher was actually the first one to see something in him, where she had this line where she said, He's somebody that you can do business with. He's not a typical Soviet apparatchik. And she was as conservative as Ronald Reagan. And he came in, and he made decisions. He wanted to end the Cold War. He wanted to cut nuclear arms drastically, as frankly did Reagan. He was willing to see the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe end. He could have invaded those countries like the Soviets did before. It might have failed, but chances are another leader would have done it. And he had a vision that made him a truly historic figure. The sad part is that he didn't consolidate his base at home. He didn't do what we were talking about before, whereas, you know, take people through change in comfortable ways.
Let's pause right there on Gorbachev. Bruce Gentleson, the book is The Peacemakers. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation with Bruce after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Duke University's Bruce Gentleson cast a very wide net as he tried to whittle down the 20th century leaders who advanced international peace and security. Among them, Maria Corrigan, a founder of the Northern Ireland Women for Peace. She started her work for peace in 1976.
Some of us got together and we said, this has got to stop. We've got to solve our problems another way because violence doesn't work. And myself and Betty Williams, whom I met the day the three children were buried, and Kieran McCune, a young journalist at the time, three of us joined together to start what became known as the Peace People. And it was a grassroots, spontaneous movement saying, you know, we have got to use different ways to solve our problems.
We're talking about the new book, The Peacemakers, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the actions of some world leaders in the 20th century affect us today? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bruce, before we went to the break there, we were wrapping up with Gorbachev. There's a lot of territory to get through with these leaders, but many would argue that President Reagan played a role here too, as you mentioned, but you didn't include Reagan in the profiles. Why is that?
Well, I include him in the story. One of the only ones where I do a direct pairing is the story of Henry Kissinger and Zhou Enlai in the breakthrough for U.S. and China back in 1971-72, because I really thought that was kind of a 50-50 partnership. But my sense of, there were very many unique aspects of Ronald Reagan, but I wasn't as convinced that another American president, given much continuity, in fact, between Republicans and Democrats throughout the Cold War, would not have responded very similarly to Gorbachev's overtures. So he is in the story, probably less than some, you know, strong Reagan fans would like, but frankly more than a lot of so-called liberal academics would put in. And I really kept the focus on Gorbachev, but did give Reagan a fair amount of credit.
Let's go to Rick waiting in Park Falls. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. My candidate is a woman whose full name is Galina Vasilyevna Starovoitova. Let's just call her Galina Starovoitova. She was a very, very educated woman. She received a degree in engineering in Leningrad from the USSR Academy of Sciences. She got a PhD in economics. She was trained also as an ethnic psychologist. Did field work in the southern part of Russia. She was President Yeltsin's advisor on inter-ethnic relations, a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., and finally ended up as a member of the Russian Federation Duma from St. Petersburg. In 1996, she attempted to run for the Russian presidency, and in 1998, she became the chairperson of Democratic Russia, which is a small-D Democrat political party. She also traveled internationally. She met Margaret Thatcher, the leader of England. She met Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan. And she was very interested in the rights of non-Russian minorities in the Russian Federation. and her principal political policy was called lustration, which is cleansing of former members of the KGB from the Russian government. And principal among those would be Vladimir Putin.
And Rick, let's pause right there. Bruce Gentleson, your reaction.
Well, this is exactly what's fun about the book, is to get people thinking about, you know, who they think made a big difference. And I've given talks recently in New York and Washington and coming to Chicago in a couple of weeks. And I've been getting different reactions from people, and it's been great, and I've been learning from it. I guess the one thing I'd say is my focus is really heavily on people on the foreign policy side. So, for example, Martin Luther King is not in the book because it was much more of an American issue. And Rick's description sounds like someone who was very important but more within Russia than sort of in the foreign policy global arena.
Greg in Niagara called in to say Jimmy Carter was a great peacemaker for his work to bring peace in the Middle East. What would you make of that, Bruce?
Very much so. I think Carter played a unique role. Somebody asked me a similar question about, you know, Anwar Sadat, and I had to say that I actually had a chapter in the workings, and it was going to be heavily on Sadat with a role for Carter.
Mm.
But I think Sadat was the crucial one. But in the business of book publishing, there were a couple chapters I was told I had to cut for length. And the Sadat chapter that would have brought Carter in was one of them. But he really did have very unique qualities in helping these leaders find some common ground. And I encourage people, in fact, to go to the Carter Center if they're ever in Atlanta, because you can see on display a lot of the photographs and letters that were exchanged. They're quite fascinating.
Well, how about Yitzhak Rabin, which is more personal story for you? He also was included in the section on the politics of identity. What about his story?
So his story is, I was also serving in the State Department in 1993-94 when the major breakthroughs were made in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I met Rabin and knew him, and I call that chapter Soldier as Peacemaker, because he went from, you know, the Minister of Defense, who actually led the crackdown on the first Palestinian Intifada in 1987 and had led Israel in many of its wars, to seeing, as he put it once, that there is no guarantee that peace will bring security to Israel, but there is no way Israel will ever be secure without peace. And he really brought it a long way, was tragically assassinated by, you know, an Israeli right-wing person who believed somehow that Rabin was violating the will of God. It's hard to say whether the peace process would have succeeded. I do go into some detail in the book about why I believe it would. You know, you can't prove it, but I make a strong argument that, just as one example, when the peace treaty was signed in 93, terrorism did spike, both against the Palestinians and against the Israelis, partly because those who don't want peace, you know, ratchet up their efforts. So in Israel, it went from 30 Israelis killed in 93 to 79 in 94. But by 1995, it was down into the 50s.
Mm.
So the tide was already turning. And there's a strong argument that we could be in a much better place for Israel, the Palestinians, and the region had Rabin survived.
So we heard that clip coming back in from the newscast there of Maria Corrigan, who founded the Northern Ireland Women for Peace. Why did you bring Betty Williams and Corrigan into your book?
Yeah, so they're in the section that we call, you know, Reconciling the Politics of Identity, where you have the Rabin profile and also Nelson Mandela. And I thought it's very important to show that it doesn't just come from generals and leaders or people of the caliber of Mandela. Mary Corrigan was an ordinary person, actually a secretary in a Guinness brewery, when in 1972, in an accident, her sister was injured and a couple of her sister's children were killed when an IRA getaway car lost control while the British police were chasing it. And she walked out of the hospital and made a statement that a BBC reporter picked up about only 1% of the people in Northern Ireland want this violence. And it went, what we would call in today's world, it went viral, you know, even in those days. And it came at a time that they called the Troubles, where the violence and the killing had ratcheted up tremendously in Ireland. And this Northern Ireland Women for Peace movement developed almost spontaneously. Betty Williams was another person who joined in, and they got a couple professional political organizers. It would be another 20 years before they signed the Good Friday Agreement. Mm. It was that breakthrough that brought the violence down. And over time, her role diminished, Corrigan and Williams, which shows, you know, sort of this person in moment, man in moment, woman in moment aspect to it. And she didn't solve it on her own, but I wanted to show how civil society can really have an impact, sometimes in very unexpected ways.
But in the book, there aren't many women in moments. Is that a reflection of what the 20th century was about, that it was a man's world?
Very much so. And I kind of put my finger on this at the beginning chapter and then come back to it at the end. And, you know, if you looked at the foreign policy world, that was the reality. I make a point at the end why I think it's changing. I mean, even in the United States, we never had a female Secretary of State. And now, since the mid-1990s, we've had three, you know, Madeleine Albright, Hillary Clinton, and Condoleezza Rice. And you're beginning to see women play more of a role, which, frankly, I think the world would benefit from enormously. But I didn't want to, you know, sort of balance it out for gender if it was not consistent with the notion of having this kind of breakthrough impact, and then wanted to address the issue about why I didn't see that balance.
Why did leaders like Mairead Corrigan, who went after very specific goals of nonviolence and reconciliation, why do they fade away?
Well, you know, that's where the political skills that we talked about earlier come in. You know, they captured the moment and they inspired people and had a vision. But, you know, to get from the A to Z of peacemaking, it really requires a whole range of skills. And they got themselves caught up in a couple of controversies that were maybe unfair, but they were really from inexperience. And people resisted, you know, the same thing. You have the so-called spoilers of peace, that when you're moving towards peace, they like to try to still blow up the train tracks. And then it took very, you know, sort of, you know, government-level diplomacy. George Mitchell from the United States played a key role, and two other Northern Irish leaders, Catholic and Protestant. And so it's part of this sense, part of what we talk about in the book, right, we don't point to, you know, who are the 21st century people, but we try to bring out strategies and see how different types of people and different types of organizations can be really crucial in different aspects of peacemaking.
We're talking with Duke University's political scientist Bruce Gentleson about his new book, The Peacemakers: Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. You can join in with the prominent peacemakers you think should get credit where credit is due. 800-642-1234. Who would make your list? Is it Mahatma Gandhi? Is it Nelson Mandela? Is it Woodrow Wilson? How do you think the actions of some world leaders in the 20th century affect where we are today in the world? And what do you think makes a leader? What do you think makes a statesman? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Bruce, you also bring in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who made his role in building international institutions, given the founding of the United Nations. What was Roosevelt's value?
Well, Roosevelt had the vision that the world would need, you know, the big powers coming out of World War II, United States, Russia, and Britain, the Soviet Union, to balance things out, but that you needed to do what Woodrow Wilson failed at. You needed to have an international organization. And he started work on this way back during World War II. You know, Pearl Harbor's attacked in December 1941. Our country is, you know, not in panic, but is quite frightened. We've had a surprise attack. We haven't mobilized for war. And the President Roosevelt is putting a lot of attention to that, you know, American industrial might, people joining the military. At the same time, he's saying, if we win this thing, we need to be planning now for what happens after. And he started that process, brought Churchill and Stalin together. He would die about 2 months before the conference actually, you know, kicking off the United Nations, which, you know, we have varying views of the United Nations, the United States today, but was totally consensual. There was bipartisan support for creating it and the treaty at the time that it was created. And he really had that vision. And that chapter is not on everything about Roosevelt, just his role in fostering the UN.
Right. So you hone in on the UN. And you also note that Roosevelt succeeded where President Woodrow Wilson, who also made the list, but failed. So what do you make of that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, and I make a confession that all professors should make every once in a while, that I actually taught Wilson the wrong way for many years. You know, I said, oh, he had this vision, he came back, he wanted to create the League of Nations, and he ran into this giant tidal wave of American isolationism. The reality is that there was some opposition, but there was lots of compromises that members of the Senate were willing to make that wouldn't have stripped the League of Nations of its core element. And Wilson, frankly, was so bloody arrogant that it was like my way or the highway. So it didn't have to happen that way. And the other thing is, when he got input from the British and French leaders about how to design this thing, he had the same attitude. So even if we had joined, the design was flawed. And so rather than Wilson as this great idealist and, you know, too bad people didn't see his vision, he didn't have the political skills, and he had too much arrogance rather than personal capital to really make it happen.
Well, let's now turn to Aung San Suu Kyi. And Paul emailed and said, how are leaders on this list reconciled with their tendencies to persecute ethnic minorities in their countries? For example, the white Afrikaners fleeing post-apartheid South Africa, the Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar. So let's now go to Aung San Suu Kyi, who you included because of her defiance of the Burma military dictatorship. What can we take away from her conflicted leadership there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we were conflicted on this because I had started writing before the Rohingya, frankly, you know, genocide, about the role, extraordinary role she played from 1988 to 2015, the personal courage, the way she was really the only figure that the pro-democracy movement could unite around. And then she, in her position, she hasn't conducted it, but she's, by most accounts, complicit. The belief that she could have said things, done things that would have reduced it, if not prevented it. And we wrestled with this a lot. And in the end, we decided to include her. This is me and my editor, entitled the chapter A Cautionary Tale, because we wanted to show how, again, we shouldn't demonize or lionize leaders like we tend to do. We wanted to show how the particular skill set she had and role and kind of persona she was, you know, was amazing for one set of peacemaking, yet it didn't carry over to another. And that indeed a lot of the stories in the book, Lech Walesa's in the book, he was a great leader of the Polish Revolution, he was a terrible president. And so we wanted to concluded for exactly that reason, as a cautionary tale, and tell both stories and draw lessons from both. And we were nervous about that because of what's happened, but we felt that if we were true to what we were doing in the book, that we needed to approach it that way.
There is no shortage of leadership studies programs, from famous Ivy League universities to one-off internet courses to self-help leadership books. Duke University's Bruce Gentleson cites the statistic. In the corporate world, a study in recent years estimated that $14 billion has been spent over the prior two decades on leadership development, twice as much as previously. Yet 75% of study respondents deemed the programs ineffective. The book is The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. You can join in with the prominent peacemakers you think should get some credit. 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the peacemakers after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There is no single formula, no secret sauce for remarkable political leadership. But there are some common traits, some parallels, and our guest, Duke University's Bruce Gentleson, takes all of those threads and through lines into account, uses some baseball calculations. One of those leaders profiled is statesman Henry Kissinger, whom Gentleson selected along with Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai for their work on U.S.-China relations. Here's Kissinger in 2017 during a conversation between the U.S. and China.
It is true that from a historic, from the point of view of history, China and the United States are almost destined for conflict.
Bruce Gentleson is a public policy and political science professor at Duke. We're talking about his new book, The Peacemakers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you think should make the list and why? What do you think of the leaders today can learn from history when it comes to the diplomatic challenges that are currently in front of us? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bruce, before we get back to these leaders, let's work through some of these emails. Jay in Appleton is wondering whether you think there's real hope for peace in the world. Globally, things seem to be getting worse. And Jay says, I'm not sure there's a real way forward.
Yeah, I understand that feeling. I think a lot of people, you know, there are times where I feel that way myself. But part of the book is really intended to show where it seemed like that many times in the past. Who thought the Cold War would end and end peacefully? Who thought that, the U.S. and China, consistent with the tape from Secretary Kissinger, you know, could go through almost a half century and not have things really break down? And who thought there could be progress in the Middle East or South Africa? So, you know, it's not naive. It's really to be inspired and take lessons. If those things happened, how can we make progress? And it's not going to be one giant piece of peace. It's going to be different elements that we have to make progress on.
It's interesting. You also give a nod to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and for their role in fostering global sustainability. Why did you put their foundation in this book? What are their role as leaders?
Yeah, the section of that book on global sustainability probably would not have been in a book 50 years ago. But as we think about climate change and the possibility of pandemics, the frightening death tolls get up there almost like, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And so in the area of global health, the Gates Foundation now has the second largest budget in the world, second only to the World Health Organization. And there are criticisms of them, and I deal with those. But it exemplifies what I call philanthropy statesmanship, where we're turning to philanthropies and other, you know, not just states to play crucial roles. And you know, without their role, there would have been less progress in some of the crucial public health issues. And they're also there as an example of many other ways in which foundations and philanthropies can and need to play that kind of role in the areas where they have the best fit.
But philanthropy is a very good thing. What do the critics have to say about them?
You know, the critics sometimes say that one expression they use is the Bill Chill. That if the Gates Foundation doesn't like an idea but other people think it's good, you know, it's hard to get funding for it because other funders take their cues from the Gates Foundation. I think there's been a sense, and some people say that, you know, they still are financed by stocks that are pharmaceutical companies and the like. Those are valid criticisms. I present them. But my, you know, bottom line sense is that they have done an enormous amount of good that people in the world have benefited from. And both of them, Bill and Melinda Gates, have been playing a leadership role in speaking at the kind of forums they get invited to. If they want a meeting with a foreign leader or an American leader, in most cases they get it. And so there really is an important role. They can't do it on their own. You do need governments and international organizations. But they're doing a lot of different issues, some in the United States, but the global public health has become one of their priority focuses.
Let's go to Carol now in Milwaukee. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. I think John Kennedy would be a good candidate. I don't know if you have him in your book, but he was He had a secret friendship with Khrushchev in which they wrote letters. They had to be very secretive because nobody should know about it because everybody would be totally shocked in the United States by that. And they were writing to each other trying to get, trying to disarm. At the end, they actually wanted to cause some disarmament, which we're going just the opposite direction right now. But they actually wanted to disarm. But before that, they got together and had that agreement where they couldn't have nuclear bombs above ground anymore, which was the major improvement. They had to have them underground. So I think it's in the book JFK and the Unspeakable. That is the book I read, which explained all that and how he really wanted peace at the end, and that was connected. The CIA was the one that killed him, and he never got his peace that he wanted, the disarmament that he wanted.
Carol, thank you so much for bringing JFK into the conversation. Bruce?
Yeah, it's interesting. He's not in the book. I think, those of us that lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis remember how frightening that was. And in the year after, prior to Kennedy's assassination, and a lot of progress, like your caller was saying, was made. We had a limited test ban treaty. We had John Kennedy giving a big speech in which he began to talk about détente. We had the first American grain sale that both helped farmers in the United States and helped Soviet Union. And historians continue to debate what might have happened if he hadn't been assassinated. Would he have gone into Vietnam? Would we have made more progress? Those are unanswered questions. So he's not in there, but I don't know that he gets great respect for how he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis in particular.
Let's go to Andy now in Towerville. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Most of the leaders are brought up by the professor. I'm presuming I haven't read your book or anything like that, but it seems like these are referenced in your book. They seem the type of Kissinger, Stalin. I mean, these men are butchers. They're terrible. These aren't representative of peace. They're forcing the hand of Western imperialism and colonialism and globalization. The screener, the handler here for the mouthpiece of our empire, they're telling me that I have to, provide someone a name of a leader. So I'm going to say Brigadier General Smedley D. Butler, founder of Veterans for Peace. He's the author of a book called War is a Racket that describes these things in detail and just shows these men aren't willing to die on their own for
it. So, Andy,
men like me to die.
Okay, so, Andy, thank you. So Andy is in favor of more non-interventionism in terms of peacemakers who should rise to the top. Bruce?
Well, we have Gandhi, we have Mandela, we have Rabin, we have lots of people like that. Stalin is not in the book, as the caller said. And Kissinger, very clear that I'm talking about the U.S.-China, not as Vietnam policy, not Chile and other things. And again, my sense is we need to, rather than put people in one box or the other, figure out what we can learn on things as complicated as peacemaking from people who are imperfect. And I think that the U.S.-China was Kissinger at his best. That doesn't take away the criticisms of Vietnam, and other aspects of his foreign policy.
Well, Stephen Madison called in to ask, what do you think of House Republicans nominating President Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula?
It seems to be coming from Republicans who are facing opposition in their own primaries. I think that's what that's all about, to be perfectly honest. I'm actually in the process of writing a short piece about one of the lessons of Gorbachev, Reagan, and Kissinger, Zhou Enlai, is that the way you get breakthroughs at summits is three factors come together, the personal, the policy, and the politics. The personal, you really have to build trust in a relationship. Frankly, I have serious doubts that either of these two leaders, President Trump or Kim Jong-un, is approaching it that way at all, nor do they have the experience or the temperament for that. And policy has to be where everybody gets something. You don't just come in and say, they did everything I wanted. And so I have real concerns about this summit. And if anybody's going to be nominated for Nobel Peace Prize, let's see the results. But that letter is pretty blatantly political by people dealing with politics inside the Republican Party.
Well, can President Trump take anything from the peacemakers you brought up from the 20th century? Can he take any of those skills into the summit with the North Korean dictator?
Absolutely.
You know, one thing is to stop saying, if he doesn't tell me what I want to say, I'm going to walk out. That didn't happen with Kissinger and Joe Enlai in their first meeting, or Gorbachev and Reagan. And he needs to know that a deal is, frankly, not like the deal maybe you make, you know, when, you know, you're a large businessman and you have small contractors. It's a deal that both sides get something. The North Koreans will absolutely want to know that the United States is not after regime change and that it's prepared to go down the road of peace. And frankly, if we abandon the Iran deal and the May 12th is the key date on that, I can't imagine the North Korean leader would agree to anything, because he'd say, well, you know, your country made one deal and you abandoned it. Why would I want to make a deal? So the personal and the policy are things that they could learn, and I believe there are people in the administration that are writing papers and giving advice along those lines. Whether or not the advice is taken is a separate question.
Let's squeeze in one more suggestion of a peacemaker here, Marcus in Wauwatosa. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. So my suggestion would be Mother Teresa.
And why is that, Marcus?
Well, because she was able to literally go into war zones and they would stop shelling and stop shooting and stop killing when she went in, even if she had no protective convoy or no other military or whatever. She just said, I'm going in, and both sides respected that. And she was able to bring peace, at least for those temporary moments. And she's done quite a lot to bring peace in other ways.
Marcus, thanks so much. Bruce Gentleson, Mother Teresa.
It's a great suggestion, and the caller makes some really good points about her. I didn't include her. I actually thought about it at one point, but in some ways, again, you make choices, and she would have sort of fit in that chapter where I have the two Northern Irish women, and I felt like that led more directly to a peace agreement than Mother Teresa's work. But I have to say that, you know, she showed enormous courage and, you know, great respect for who she was and everything she did.
Well, great conversation, Bruce. Thank you so much for spending time with us. We always appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kate. Appreciate you having me.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. His new book is The Peacemakers: Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. It's a sweeping look across the last century to identify 15 transformational people who bent the flow of politics toward peace and stability, lessons we can learn today. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Brianne Chasseau and Ideas Network Director Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about peacemakers, you find it on the Ideas Network.